I'm Ross Reynolds. Berkeley sociologist Arlie Hochschild is the author of many books, including The Second Shift. She comes from the left liberal enclave of Berkeley, California. Well, about 5 years ago, she decided to go to a very different place to visit with low-income people in rural Louisiana. And her purpose was to understand the conservative movement, which has embraced Donald Trump. The result is her book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Hochschild also adapted a section of that book into an article in Mother Jones magazine called I Spent 5 Years with Some of Trump's Biggest Fans. Here's What They Won't Tell You. I spoke to Arlie Hochschild September 26, 2016. She was in the studios of WNYC Radio in New York City. I began with, what was it like for you, Arlie Hochschild, a sociologist from Berkeley, California, to try to win the trust of arch conservatives in Louisiana?
They couldn't have been more open. We're the flyby state. People don't know we're here. They think we're racist and homophobic and sexist, and we get dismissed. So thank you for coming and trying to find out who we are. And what I'd done is tried to get out of my political bubble and come to a completely equal and opposite political bubble.
And when you said sociologist from Berkeley, that didn't set off alarms in their head?
It did. I mean, some people said, oh, so that's where you're from. I say, yeah. And some said, oh, you got a lot of hippies over there. One guy, super Tea Party person, said, so you're a communist, right? And then he laughed. And I said, okay, if he knew he was telling a joke, I could talk to this guy. And he turned out to be a major person in the book. This is a book about people and taking the reader into the lives of white, generally working class people who have amazing lives. I went with a searching the answer to what I thought of as a red state paradox. How come the red states, the poor states with worse education, health care, lower life expectancy, who get more federal dollars in help than they give in taxes, and who hate the federal government? How does that fit together? I just didn't get it. And Louisiana turned out to be, as now the poorest state, turned out to be really an exaggerated version of that. They knew that that was a paradox, but it wasn't as important as something else.
And you explain this by talking about a deep story they tell themselves. What is that deep story, and what is a deep story?
A deep story is a story of life as it feels like to you. You take the judgments out. You take the facts out. It's life as it feels. And we all have a deep story. But the deep story for the far-right people that I came to know was this. Imagine yourself waiting in line, a long line, like in a pilgrimage, to the top of a hill where there is the American dream. You've been waiting for a long time. You've worked very hard for it. You have a sense of deserving, and the line is not moving. Then you see some people seem to cut ahead of you. And who are they? Well, they're immigrants. They're affirmative action blacks who want access to formerly all-white jobs, or women who want access to formerly all-male jobs. And then you see refugees, even public sector workers. These people seem to be cutting ahead of you and pushing you back when you haven't had a raise in 30 years, 20. And then they see in this deep story that President Obama and the Democratic Party is helping the line cutters and not you, not speaking to you and your needs, just to the line cutters. And then you think, well, that's terrible. I need another government. I am a stranger in my own land. And then you see someone ahead of you in line turn around and say, oh, you ignorant redneck. And then that's it. You just feel ignored, dismissed, misunderstood. And you turn elsewhere for representation.
And here you have Donald Trump, who's perfectly happy to say these things that you, as a poor white Southerner, get castigated for.
Exactly right.
What about this narrative that poor people in Louisiana told you? What about it is true?
I don't think we're competing. I think there are a number of lines. And that to the extent that there's line cutting, I think there are reasons for it that are invisible to them. And I think the line cutters, they don't know them. They haven't talked to them. They're not sitting down at a fish fry. There's an absence of communication because, again, we're in these separate enclaves. I had something happen just the day before yesterday. I was giving a talk at a bookstore in New Orleans, and one of the men that I write about in the book was in the audience. And so I gave my talk, and afterwards there were questions. A black woman teaches African American studies in New Orleans, said, well, how did race figure into this? How did the people you talk about feel about race? And I gave an answer. I said, well, they define racism as, is anybody, are you mad at a black person or are you, do you use the N-word? And that's a pretty narrow definition of racism, but that's what they feel. It's how they define it. And so we talked a little bit. After that, this white Tea Party Trump supporter got into a conversation with this black professor of African American studies. They got, now they're meeting. Now they're planning on a little reading and getting together. The purpose of my book is to enhance that, because people are forming ideas about people that they haven't met, that they don't know.
In your book, you describe the living conditions of these low-income white people in Louisiana to a degree that I didn't quite realize how bad it is for them. Could you talk a little bit about what's facing them day to day?
Yes. A keyhole issue in Strangers in Their Own Land is the environment. And I discovered that not only are red states poorer, have worse schools, medical care, families more disrupted, but they also live in more environmentally polluted lands. And they often have state regulatory systems that are weak because of the politicians they elect, so that they're living with more pollution. Louisiana, for example, is one of the most polluted states in the country, and it has the second highest death from cancer rate for men. So they're suffering from pollution. And so I asked one informant that I really got to know, a friend, why are you voting for Donald Trump? Because the one thing he's really clear about is that he wants to abolish the Environmental Protection Agency. How could you be suffering this much pollution? And in fact, he'd been evacuated from his community because of a drilling accident that could have been prevented by stricter regulation. And yet he was voting for a guy that wanted to get rid of that regulation. I asked him, well, how does this, I don't understand. And he said, well, actually, I don't think Trump means it. Well, you know, then why is he saying it? He's saying it because he just wants to get people to vote for him. But when he's in office, he's not going to do that, he felt. And so he didn't actually believe what Trump said. But the other thing was that the state itself felt toxic to this man and to others that I came to know. And I thought, how does that make any sense? And partly, this was the South, he saw the state as an instrument of the North, and then he saw the state as an instrument of oil. And now he's seeing the state as an instrument for the promotion of others to get ahead of him in line. And so the state became, in his view, a kind of a bad actor. And the oil part is really something important here, because I think that Louisiana may be something we can all learn from. The oil companies have seduced and captured the state. The state is giving, as gave, $1.5 billion to new oil and petrochemical plants coming in. And with that money, many of these companies are giving donations to the Audubon Society and school programs. So the companies are smelling like a rose. They seem to be the givers. Meanwhile, the state, because it is on bended knee to companies, is going light on regulation. And then people are saying, well, the state isn't protecting our health and our air and our water, yet we're paying taxes to it. And these are people who want to save their pennies because for 20 years they haven't had a raise or their incomes may be going down. So I think that's a piece of the suspicion of the state that we really need to listen to and turn around.
So there's a deep distrust of the state and any kind of government action. And there's also a distrust of news accounts which say Donald Trump is talking about eliminating the EPA. And that leads me to wonder where the people you talk to, low-income whites in Louisiana, are getting their information from.
They're getting it from Fox News, and Fox has been very clever. I don't think Fox News created this discontent, but I think it's become very clever at speaking to it and reaffirming stereotypes and feeding a great deal of misinformation to people. But one woman, I said, oh, Fox is like family. I stayed with her, and by her desk and computer, there was a small television, Fox. And in the evening with her husband, she sat down, Fox. And she said, well, they're a little like family. O'Reilly's like dad, and Megyn Kelly is like the sassy, smart daughter, and Hannity is the acerbic uncle. She actually had soft family in Fox.
We like to think that people who tell themselves deep stories that are questionable are other people. But what about the deep stories that we in Seattle and folks in Berkeley tell themselves about the way that the world is? What's that deep story? And is that more connected to reality than the deep story that poor Southerners tell themselves in Louisiana?
This is a great question. I think the deep story for progressives is that we're all ranged around a public square. And we're not exactly holding hands because we're ready to incorporate others as they range themselves around the public square. In the middle of that square is a state-of-the-art children's science museum, just funded, looks great. It's got public schools that are fantastic and museums that stay open for long hours and don't cost much to go to, libraries that are buzzing places, a whole public square that we have worked to build, that we believe in, and whether we're private sector or nonprofit or public sector workers, this feels wonderful to us. Then we see a marauder come in, pick out a big chunk of concrete from that state-of-the-art children's museum and haul it off behind our backs to build a McMansion. Privatization, lower taxes. We're imagining a disintegration and a destruction of this integrative, available to all public square. And we're horrified at that and threatened by that. And we don't know who these marauders are. They're only the enemy. And we're not climbing any empathy wall to kind of figure out who these marauders really are. What's their daily life like? How does that make sense to them? So I think that's the progressive deep story.
And is the progressive deep story any more or less accurate than the deep story which these poor Southerners told you for this book?
I think every deep story both filters truth in and filters other truths out. And what I think the deep story of progressives filters out is that not everyone is benefiting from this public square. It's an idealization of the state. It's an idealization of government. It's government what it could be. I happen to share that faith and desire to make government all it can be, but it filters out the story I found in Louisiana of a government that had been swallowed up by private interests, big companies, and wasn't doing a good job.
Let's say that Donald Trump is elected president in November. How does that affect the attitudes of Trump supporters who believe in him and yet distrust government if he becomes the leader?
That's the paradox that my book, I think, delivers us to. I went in with a red state paradox, but I came out with two more different paradoxes, one for the right, one for the left. For the right, the paradox is a lot of people on the right have wanted a small government, cut the federal deficit and size of government. And yet Donald Trump is calling for 90,000 new troops, and he's not saying how that is going to raise the deficit. He's calling for getting all undocumented workers out of the United States. That would take a surveillance state that would cost an arm and a leg and put the deficit off way over the limit it's at now. So, yeah, there is, that's a paradox. And the right is invited to look at that fair and square. The left paradox is that many have thought of the Democratic Party as the party of the working man, of the poor man, against the 1% and special interests at the top. But then the question is, why isn't the working man voting for the Democratic Party?
You spent 5 years studying the attitudes and talking to arch conservatives in Louisiana. Are there questions that are still unanswered for you, having even spent all this time with them? Are there still things that puzzle you about their attitudes and their narration?
I think I do have the hang of how they think. But what puzzles me is, why isn't there more attempt to be curious about people in a very different enclave? And why aren't we busy getting acquainted with people very different from ourselves? Because I think there's a lot of crossover we could get to. For example, this man I was just telling you about lost his home and community to a drilling accident, and voting for Trump, who wants to abolish the EPA. That man said, you know, we ought to get money out of politics. I thought, well, that's a good left-right crossover issue. And he also said, you know, we need to reduce prison populations. I mean, this is a lot of nonviolent crimes. Let's get people back to the community so they can be good fathers and mothers to their kids. Okay, that's another one. And let's clean up the environment. This man has become an environmentalist. And why isn't that a good crossover issue?
So there are issues on which the left liberal and the right conservative might make common cause on, were they to actually talk.
Exactly. I see crossing the empathy wall and taking your political alarm system off to really listen and be curious. It's a marvelous thing to do. And first of all, I think it's enlarging. And second of all, you find that you agree on a lot more than you'd think.